welcome to the first episode of Modcast, Candid Chats with Industry Innovators and Leaders. I'm Scott Thomas, co-founder and chief experience officer of Mod IntelliKey. And today, I have the pleasure of speaking with my good friend, client, and industry leader, Brian Peters, who's also chief experience officer at Bucket List Events. A little bit about Brian. He's a proud graduate of the University of Texas. We graduated a degree in electrical engineering. He's a member of Entrepreneurs Organization, as well as a past president of the Austin EO chapter. As part of EO, he's also a graduate of the Founding of Giants program at MIT. Brian's founded and run several companies and had exits as well. And Bucket List Events is his latest endeavor. Married with one son, he enjoys golf, the Masters in particular, and of course, travel. Again, thanks for joining.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start out. Tell me a little bit about how you got started. You started a company called Red Carpet Events in 2004.
Red Carpet Tickets.
Tickets, sorry.
Yeah, yes. It was about event tickets. We had a contract with a company called Club Corp. They own golf and dining resorts nationwide. And we had an exclusive relationship with them to provide their members with event tickets for everything in their local market, the local college team, the local sports teams, concerts, theater. And that was from 2004 till about 2015, I guess. We would do anywhere from $10 to $15 million a year in revenue. Anywhere from 10 to 20 employees at any given point in time. And then I sold that business in January of 2015 to a group out of Kentucky, actually. And was on an earnout with them for another year and a half, I guess.
For everyone's edification, you mind talking a little bit, just you don't have to talk about the specifics, but the earnout. I don't think everyone knows what that.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, so I went from being the owner of a company to being basically an employee of a company. I was paid well, but I didn't make the decisions anymore. For a little bit, for a short while, that was sort of liberating. I didn't have to worry about the next payroll cycle, or I didn't have to worry about much of anything, really. I just had to answer the phone if they called me. But eventually, you get the itch back, right? And so, about a year and a half into a two-year earnout, I approached them and said, there's this piece of the business that I always enjoyed more than the rest of it. The ticket business, chasing down tickets for a Taylor Swift concert or a Dallas Cowboys game. I mean, it was got to be a grind. But what I always enjoyed was the experience on the ground at a major event. So I loved the Olympics. I loved the Masters is my favorite by a wide margin. I loved these experiences where we were on the ground, we met clients face to face instead of shipping them a FedEx envelope with tickets. And so I approached the company that had bought Red Carpet Tickets, and I said, you know, there's this piece of the business that I don't think you can do without me, and I'm leaving when my earnout is done, but I'd be willing to buy it back from you. It took 6 weeks or so to negotiate, but in the end, I bought the tour experience piece of the business back from them. We had a division we called Bucket List Events at the time, and I bought those assets back from them. And that was the founding of my Bucket List Events. We incorporated that as its own business in May of 2017.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. So, you know, when that decision was made, was the company that bought the event portion, were they really paying attention to it in your mind? Because you mentioned, hey, you can't do it without me. Or was that when they bought it? Did they kind of just leave it sort of steady state, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, so they bought Red Carpet Tickets for the ticket piece, and even more so than that, the relationship with Club Corp. They turned around and sold the relationship with Club Corp to another entity. They made more on that than they had spent with me, you know, acquiring Red Carpet Tickets. So they made their money, and they were content just to ride out the ticket business. Okay. Meanwhile, we were on site for the Rio Olympics. Mm-hmm. We were on site for the next Masters, and it took my team, my old Red Carpet team, to fulfill that. They had no experience in fulfilling a hospitality experience on the ground. So we were doing the tour business, they were doing the ticket business, and they sold the Club Corp relationship and made their money. So it just seemed natural. I wanted to buy back this piece of the business that I was fulfilling anyway for them and that I actually enjoyed.
I want to go forward to now, but I think the Club Corp piece. So did you know when you sold it that Club Corp would be the crown jewel?
Oh, absolutely.
But you did.
It was an exclusive contract with, I mean, Club Corp, for those who don't know, they own something like 250 golf and dining resorts nationwide, about 400,000 members. Average household income, I think, is over $200,000. So it's an affluent audience to have exclusive access into. So that was the crown jewel. Now, here's a funny story. After the company in Kentucky bought us, sold the Club Corp relationship to another entity in Atlanta. Mm. So for 2 years, Club Corp was with that company in Atlanta called Prime Sport. When their contract was up with Prime Sport, Club Corp approached me at the next Masters and asked, could we please come back? We prefer the way you serve the Masters. So I actually, when it's all said and done, my bucket list events has the relationship with Club Corp once again to serve our events.
Nice. I mean, when I hear something like that, I'm always interested in kind of the importance of relationships, right? I mean, everyone says it. But even at a business transaction level, right? Because when I hear that, right?
Absolutely.
The relationship survives, you know, all those sort of gyrations and who owns what. And
it's unbelievable. Right. But yes, it's the relationships that matter the most. You don't buy from a company, you buy from a person at a company.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the Masters, right? I was going to ask you your favorite event, but I think I know the answer. So I mean, talk a little bit about that, because I'm always interested in, and there's a lot of discussion on business and passion, right? So some people are like, hey, follow your passion, that'll turn into your business. And there's sort of a counter discussion on, well, not every passion should turn into a business.
I have the irony is, right, in some ways I founded this business because I love the Masters so much. The irony is, so I'm in Augusta for the entire week, every week of the Masters for the last 21 years, but the business has gotten so large, I get to spend less and less time actually on the golf course because I've got so many clients to take care of. But back to my favorite event, the Masters, more than any other event I could think of, has done the best job of maintaining tradition. So when you walk out onto the golf course, there is no marketing, there's no billboards, there's no signage, there's no hospitality tents. That doesn't exist. It's just you and the golf course. By the way, to get on the golf course, you have to leave your cell phone at home. There's no cell phones on the golf course. You're disconnected from technology for an entire day on the most beautiful piece of real estate in America. It's an otherworldly experience. And the prices, concessions, sandwiches, ham and cheese on rye, $1.75. You want a beer? 2.25. And then it's unbelievable. It's like you just step back into the 1970s.
That's great. You know, you see less and less of that. Do you think?
You don't see it anywhere.
Right. I mean, the fact that they're doing that, and they protect the experience so hardcore, right? I mean, what do you see in other events and in other areas is people monetize it. And when they try to monetize it, it loses some luster.
The event everybody always points to is the Super Bowl. And the Super Bowl is the antithesis of the Masters, in my opinion. You've got a totally corporate event. Mind you, most of the people that are at the Super Bowl got their tickets because they were the top salesperson at their Fortune 500 company. They're not a fan of either team. Most of the people at the Super Bowl don't care who wins. I mean, so as far as an NFL football game goes, it's one of the least exciting to be at because there's not a home crowd in the stadium. It's a very sanitized, corporate, $15 beers, if you're lucky, experiences. So the exact opposite of what the Masters is and tries to protect.
So, no, then that's great. So I want to talk a little bit about the travel, because I think that speaks to more and more you hear a lot of things about people looking for authentic experiences, right? I think the irony is, how do things that are authentic stay authentic, right? Because things tend to get overloved. I'll give Austin as an example, right? There's some people, you know, as something grows, how do you preserve what's great about it?
Exactly. That is a challenge.
Right. Do you target in your business, so example, we went to Pamplona with you guys and had a great experience. I mean, to the point of Toby literally was watching our two-year-old. I don't think most, I mean, we're friends as well, but I don't think most organizations would do that. How do you grow and be authentic, right? And not sell out? I know that's a big question, right?
Well, and there's a couple of ways I could answer that. I mean, so one thing I would tell you is that, first off, we only serve the events that we enjoy. I don't particularly enjoy the Super Bowl. We don't provide the Super Bowl.
Okay.
We like going to Pamplona for the Running of the Bulls, which, by the way, has been going on in Pamplona for hundreds of years down the exact same street. And they do a good job of protecting their tradition. Same for Oktoberfest in Munich. It's been going on for hundreds of years on the same grounds, in the same tents. It's a very similar experience today as it was 200 years ago.
Yeah.
It's those events we really enjoy the most, and we enjoy sharing them with people who are passionate to see them.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So in your business, you operate largely remotely.
We do. Well, not largely, completely.
Completely, right. Can you talk a little bit about that model, for lack of a better term, right? Challenges, upside, downside, and, you know, kind of what your day-to-day is and, you know, what you've learned, and will you ever go back?
I used to think we might go back, but no longer. No, I love it now. For many years, from 2004 to 2015, I believed you had to have an office to have a business. Good grief, I think at the Hill Country Galleria, I was paying $7,000 a month for my space, and it wasn't big enough. We were looking for more. With Bucket List Events, the initial idea was we're gonna keep our overhead as low as possible. One of the guys that I knew had to work for me lived in Round Rock. One of the girls we wanted to work for us, she lives in Munich, which made it very convenient for Oktoberfest, but she wasn't going to be commuting to an office in Austin. So by design, we had to solve for that. It has been a learning experience. I would say early on, when we were just three people, it was very easy to have a three-way conference call and everybody could just talk. As you add a fourth and then a fifth and it grows from there, yeah, it became very important for us to figure out the tools to have effective meetings and to have accountability when everyone in your office is remote. But everybody dials in from wherever they are in the world. It is a video conference meeting, and we've got a very structured agenda set up that we follow. So everybody, you know, basically we start with some good news, we review the numbers for this past week, and then everybody's got a 8-minute window to present what they've been working on this past week and what they're working on for the next week. Throughout the entire meeting, throughout those updates, we listen for issues, and anytime an issue comes up, we quickly record that issue down at the bottom of our agenda. And then when the last of the updates is done, we've got another 45 minutes or so to go through the issues one by one. We take whatever issue is the highest priority and address it. Hopefully the conversation around the issue boils down to action items that make it into somebody's commitments for the next week. And at the end of the meeting, we rate it and offer one suggestion that we could do better to make the next meeting even better. And ever since we switched that model, it's been phenomenal.
All right. So I'm hearing, it sounds like some process things. Correct. Zoom is, you know, technology, right, for video conferencing, audio conferencing, screen sharing.
We use Zoom, and then we track the agenda and the accountability in a Google document. That's it.
Yeah.
We looked at Trello and tried that for a while. It didn't quite fit. Right now we're looking at Asana as a possible better tool for us.
So it's interesting you say kind of that the remote model, because, you know, they say necessity is the mother of invention, right? Because there's a lot of talk about doing things remotely. It's another thing if people do it well, or if it's what I call a sideshow, right?
Right.
Like, partly you don't have a choice. So the reason I bring that up in the way that sort of we work together is we see that with clients, right? There's a lot of folks that adopt the technology. But if there isn't like a pain point that drives them to use it, a lot of times it doesn't get used, right? So this kind of leads to, I know you guys use HubSpot for CRM, right? And other tools.
Correct.
Maybe talk a little bit about that. And I say that just for context, because people, Salesforce, HubSpot, there's a lot of different tools. It runs a gamut. I would say you guys use it much more than I would say any of our other clients, you know, for the most part. Others may use it, but it's not core to their business, is what I would argue. Talk a little bit about that.
I'm a huge HubSpot fan. A few years back, the old company, you know, I started with Salesforce and was paying Salesforce prices. A couple of years later, I was introduced to Zoho, which was, it's just like Salesforce for half the price. And so I used Zoho. And then somewhere along the way, someone said, well, HubSpot is the same thing and it's basically free. I mean, no, it's not, but
right.
But the CRM portion is.
Yep.
And so on a whim, I switched to HubSpot just to see. And it has been life-changing. In a remote office, it's important to keep track of the conversations, not just that I've had with a client, but that someone else has had with a client. Mm-hmm. So on our fulfillment side, the person who's delivering an experience at the Masters or at the Tokyo Olympics needs to be able to quickly pull up a document that the salesperson shared with them and what's included in their package. And so HubSpot has allowed us to keep track of our conversations and view one another's conversations much more efficiently than we ever had before.
Oh, that's great. What I hear is, you know, that is driven largely by necessity, right? Again,
remote.
And that's what, you know, we see with clients, right, is even if it's sort of a top-down imposition, unless they have to use it, right, everybody's busy, the CRM is a sideshow, right? It's obviously core to your business. What I want to talk about is you've also taken it to the next level, right?
I have, thanks to you, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually have to commend you on that. For a long time, we used HubSpot, and everything that we did in HubSpot, we did manually. So if I had a client ask me for a quote for the Masters or for the Olympics, I had a template that I had written up and I would copy and paste it and press send by hand. And on occasions where we would send out an email blast to all of Club Corp's members, I might end up with 1,000 requests for a quote for the Masters in one day.
Yep.
And I literally, that is one day's worth of work to copy and paste and press send on an email. Even though the email's already written, it takes a full day to do that. And so it was a very inefficient system. And if there's one thing above all else that I've gotten out of our relationship, it's the automation of that process in ways that I never knew were possible, didn't know existed. So now we have the auto response feature set up in HubSpot, where if someone requests information on the Masters, they get an email back from me personally without me ever pressing send.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, they get a follow-up email a week later asking them if they have any questions about it, and then a follow-up email a week later than that, reminding them that time is running out. And so the manual labor portion of the CRM experience has been automated,
right,
thanks to you and your company, and I'm beyond thankful for that.
I appreciate it. So I have a question on that. So, and I don't know if it's related to this, but so you're an engineer by training way, way back.
Yeah, but barely. I can barely remember that.
Right. But I would argue that there's probably a mindset related to that, right? Meaning sort of automation, yes. Efficiency. So I may be characterizing you. I'm a marketer, so you know, this is what I do. How do you get other folks who may not be as bought in to buy into CRM and automation, right? So you're obviously the founder and the owner, but how do you get other folks on the team? Has that been a challenge? Has that been easy? Can you talk maybe a little bit about that?
Well, we automate it for them, so there's no buy-in. It happens for them whether they bought in or not. And in fact, there's some benefit to that, right? I have managed large sales teams, significantly large sales teams. And there's always a challenge when you manage salespeople that they all have a different message. They all have something different in their mind and they're making different promises to their clients.
Oh, yeah.
And that has been one of the big benefits about setting up templates and having auto responses in HubSpot is that I now control the message. This is exactly what's promised. This is what's included in a package.
Right.
And no, I'm sorry, we're not going to have a limo to take you back and forth each day, no matter what you might have heard. This is what's included in your program. And so that's been a big benefit to us.
Yeah. And not a whole lot of, you know, folks getting what I like to call creative. Other people say rogue,
exactly.
Right? Especially sales folks, right? Like,
there's salespeople that will say anything to close the deal. And it's much healthier to control the message.
Okay. Oh, that's good. So I want to talk about kind of the decision behind that, right? So us working together, but just in general in your business, right? Because I'm always curious on decision-making frameworks, right? Or just how it happens. So in your business, how do you decide to work with a marketing agency? How do you decide to outsource your software, right? What do you have a philosophy on what to keep in-house and what to outsource from a partnering standpoint?
I think you should do what you're good at and outsource the rest.
Okay.
So could I figure out how to do my taxes? Probably, I'm intelligent, but am I better off hiring a CPA to do that for me? Yes.
Okay.
What we're good at is delivering an experience on the ground at a major event. That's who we are.
Yeah.
Anything related to delivering that experience, I want to own. But I am not a marketer by trade. That is a skill set I just don't have, and so I outsource it.
Yeah, no, and that's great. And so we interact with lots of different people, right? But a lot of sales folks, I think, because it's not like a CPA or a doctor goes to, right? Like, yes,
right.
People go to school for marketing, but largely it's learned in the field. How does someone figure out that maybe marketing is not their core competency? Because we've seen clients and others, and this is other fields as well, try to do marketing, right? Or the automation, or what I like to call DIY, right? They want to go to Home Depot, pick up all the stuff instead of hiring a contractor.
Right.
did you early on try to go to Home Depot for marketing and then figure out, I'm not good at building a shed? Or did you just leap over that process and say, look, I know I don't want to go to Home Depot and build my marketing, just to use an analogy, right?
In all honesty, what you have done, what your company has done to automate HubSpot for us, I didn't know was possible. I wouldn't have known to go to Home Depot and buy the parts. I didn't know it was even possible.
Okay.
So you opened up new doors for me.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Tell me about your own personal episode of Locked Up Abroad.
Well, we had a big program for the Brazil World Cup in 2014, and quite a few clients, a lot of people coming and going. I rented an office space in the top floor of a hotel in Rio de Janeiro. And that was our office, and I had all my employees there, and clients would come to meet and pick up and go. some of the local police thought, I wonder what's going on up there, and they raided our office. Now, it is illegal to sell tickets for sporting events in Brazil for more than face value. That's a fact. Now, mind you, all of our clients were there picking up tickets that they had purchased in the States a month before, where it's entirely legal to sell a ticket for more than face value. But nevertheless, we got raided. Four police with guns out and, you know, badges up, guns out. What's going on in here? Who's in charge? Well, I'm in charge, and there's nothing illegal going on here. I'm not the least bit worried. Well, they rounded up every ticket that they could find in the office. They rounded up all the money that they could find. Now, mind you, I had a lot of tickets in the office. I still had all the tickets for the finals and the semifinals, the quarterfinals, the round 16, the most valuable tickets. Those clients weren't in town yet, so I'm still holding their tickets for them. So anyway, they round up all the tickets and me, and we're going to go down to the police station and just figure this all out. So I'm thinking, okay, this will be a quick bribe and I'll be on my way home. Well, it was 15 days later before I got out of there. They kept all the cash. They kept about half of the tickets. They gave me some back, saying that that was all that they'd recovered. And I spent 15 days in the Brazilian prison system.
Wow.
And whatever you imagine it to be, it's probably a little bit worse than that.
So they put you in, like, general population?
They put us in a wing of the prison. By the way, the prison was called Bangu, B-A-N-G-U. And you can Google it sometime, and you'll get some pretty graphic pictures that come up on Google of beheadings and riots. And, I mean, it is a very bad place to be. Now, in fairness, they put us in a wing of the prison for trustees, the better prisoners who worked in the prison system. You know, we got two meals a day and a little hole in the ground as a toilet, and we weren't treated badly. But it was poor living conditions, to say the least.
So we were the only one arrested?
So I raised my hand, said I'm in charge. They took me to the police station. At the police station, they talked to the chief of police and said, look what we've uncovered, look at what we found. And she said, were there more people in the office? And the policeman said, yes. And she said, well, go back and get all of them. So my two most valuable employees were still, when they saw me get taken away, they shut the office down, they set up operations separately, and they took all the computers out and shut the office down. But they were still in the office in the last stage of that process when the police came back. So my two most valuable employees who ran operations for the event also came and spent 15 days in the prison system, which is a testament to how having great people working for you beneath and having good systems. So all of our clients, in spite of the fact that all our cash was stolen by the police, half of our tickets were stolen by the police, and the three people running the event were all behind bars. In spite of all that, all of our clients had a positive experience. None of them had anything negative happen. They all got their tickets on time. They all had their transfers, their plane flights. Everything worked for the clients. We got very positive reviews from our clients at the end of the event. But the entire operations management team was behind bars for the duration of the event. Here's the thing about Brazilian prison. I could probably give you 50 guesses, and you wouldn't guess the worst thing about that experience. Mosquitoes. It was unbelievable, the mosquito situation in that prison.
Just open air, right? Is that why? Or?
Oh, I mean, so you had a 20-foot wall in your cell, and then up at the top it was open air, and so the mosquitoes would come in there, and they would line the walls up at the top, and then when the lights turned off, they would descend in mass. And I remember sleeping with a, you learn to pull the sheet all the way over your head and around you to keep the mosquitoes off of you. And I would hold the sheet over, the first night I held the sheet over my head and my knuckles were exposed to the open air. And I had two or three mosquito bites on every knuckle. About halfway through our stay, there were some British guys who got arrested the same way. And the prison didn't have any blankets or sheets to give them on their first night. And one of the guys had so many mosquito bites his first night that he had to go to the hospital the next day. I mean, head to toe, nothing but mosquito bites. It was unbelievable.
Wow. But no shankings?
No. Okay. No shankings. But the guy in the cell across from us had killed 23 people to be there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you talk to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was a reasonably nice guy. I certainly wasn't going to say anything to piss him off.
Right. Did he just volunteer that?
No, somebody else told us about him.
Huh. Wow. It's a little unsettling.
So eventually the U.S. Embassy, the U.S. Embassy would come and they'd check on us.
Yeah.
Eventually, we were released. We had to hand over our passports to be released, and we weren't allowed to leave until the trial. Mm-hmm. So that meant, when it was all said and done, I spent 6 months in Brazil, from the time I first got there to the trial, and then waiting for the judge's verdict. By the way, we were acquitted of everything.
Right.
In fact, the judge apologized to me for the experience we'd been through. But yeah, I spent 6 months in Brazil fighting that battle.
So guilty until proven innocent.
Police in Brazil are not paid much. I mean, it's sort of a thing where they all have second jobs. Sort of the way, people talk in the United States about being a school teacher. It's a noble profession, but it doesn't pay enough.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same for police there. They're very low paid. And so they all either have second jobs or when they see an opportunity to squeeze some money out of people, they will.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was very frustrated by that. So, I told my lawyer, I was like, well, I want to fight that. They stole half of my finals tickets and they stole all of my cash. I want that back. And my lawyer told me, don't say anything. That's how you make this situation much worse.
Wow. So in prison 15 days, where'd you go out? Because you were there 6 months, right?
I was in prison for 15 days. They let us out pending trial. And so we rented an apartment in Copacabana.
Oh, okay.
And I had my voice over IP phones. And that was my first experience with remote officing. So I had two key employees with me and a full office full of people back here in Austin. And we learned about video conference meetings and I just operated as if I was in the States. Meanwhile, I was kept missing deadlines in the States that I thought I would be back for because we'd already had the trial and it was obvious we were going to win. So as those kept mounting, finally I told the other two people I was with, I can't wait. Oh, well, I was negotiating the sale of my business at that time and I needed to go meet the purchasers. So I went to the embassy in Rio and asked them for a temporary passport, which they gave me. And I hired a driver to drive me essentially 24 hours from Rio all the way across the width of Brazil to Iguazu Falls, which is on the border with Argentina and Paraguay.
Yeah.
Paraguay is the
forgot about that
more important. And so I got out of that car and rode across the border on a motorcycle because they will stop and inspect cars, but on a motorcycle not so much. So I rode across the border into Paraguay on the back of a motorcycle, rejoined my driver who drove me a couple of hours to Asuncion, Paraguay, where I caught an American Airlines flight and went home. Now, I fly home, my wife meets me at the Austin airport, We haven't seen each other for months. We hug and kiss and can't believe you're home. And as I was driving out of the airport, we haven't left the grounds of the airport, we haven't turned onto the highway from the airport, my phone rings and it's my lawyer. And he says, Brian, I have great news. The judge is ready to sign the documents, hand you back your passport. You're done. Just come into the office so that you can sign. And I said, well, Talis, I am very sorry, but I'm in the States right now. No, 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 this is all done, but you have to sign. You have to be here to sign. So I said, give me 1 week and I'll be back. And so I went, I negotiated the sale of the business, got all the paperwork done on that, went to an EO board meeting, and then I did the entire trip in reverse. I flew into Asuncion, Paraguay, had a taxi drive me to the border, went across the border on the back of a motorcycle, rented a bus, and took a 24-hour bus ride to Rio. Got off downtown Rio, went straight to the courthouse, met my lawyer there, signed the paperwork, and they handed me back the passport that they'd been holding for 6 months. But I wanted to see it through. I needed to resolve the issue. This was the 2014 World Cup, yeah. And I knew that I would be servicing the 2016 Olympics. And so, you know, there were a number of people in the ticket business who got arrested in 2014 who skipped the country and just left. I knew I needed to come back and I didn't want any issues coming back into the country for the Olympics. So that's why I stayed, had the court case, fought it until I won. And
wow, that's playing the long game.
Well, I went back with my head held high in 2016.
Right. Wow. You should have been locked up in abroad, but you know.
I would have loved to have been, actually. Right. Yeah, there's plenty of interesting prison stories that probably aren't appropriate for this setting.
Maybe we'll just start a new podcast called Prison Stories. Thanks for sharing it. You haven't shared it, like, we've talked it little bits and pieces at, like, dinner and stuff, but I was also like, I don't know how far I go.
Oh, I don't mind.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about entrepreneurship, take it a little different tack.
Sure.
It's getting a lot of play right now, in general. People talk about it, podcasts like this. Can you talk a little bit about what your favorite part of being an entrepreneur and then maybe your least favorite part?
Least favorite part is fairly easy. I mean, it's a lonely place to be, being an entrepreneur. There are things that come up that there's just no one you can talk with. If you're worried about making payroll, you can't call in your number one employee and say, hey, I'm worried about making payroll this week. And you can't necessarily talk with your wife about it because she's worried about, are we going to be evicted from our home or, you know, foreclosed on our home? So it's lonely. And that's been the value of the entrepreneur organization for me, mm-hmm. is being in a peer group of like-minded people. Entrepreneurship. Yeah. I think the best definition of an entrepreneur I ever heard is that an entrepreneur is someone who jumps off a building and figures out how to build wings on the way down. It's a personality type. I can't work for someone else. I need to do this myself.
Right.
And that's, I don't know, it's exciting. It's liberating. For me, I love growing revenue. I mean, like, I stay up at night figuring out how are we going to increase revenue? How are we going to sell more? How are we going to make this better so that we sell more? That's where I get my energy from.
Okay. No, that's great. Thank you. Because a lot of people won't talk about what I call the downside, right? I think it's entrepreneurship. There's a lot of, you know, the upside discussion, right? Especially when the economy, good, right? You know, I talked a little bit about, you know, you just got an engineering degree. Now you're running, you know, a vet company, right? Do you mind talking a little bit about that journey? And maybe it wasn't much of a journey, but I'm curious to know.
Oh, I got out of the University of Texas and I was working for IBM. And then that transitioned into a PC manufacturing company. And I was I was selling PCs to a fellow that owned a ticket company. And margins on PCs were getting smaller, but the ticket industry was looking more and more interesting because the internet was just coming about and people were trying to figure out how to buy tickets online. And so there came an opportunity to create this software product to serve the ticket industry. Yeah. And so I left the PC industry behind and co-founded a company called Real-Time Ticketing to make software for ticket brokers. And I traveled all around the world signing up ticket brokers to use this software product. And the key piece of that story is they would invite me into their office. I mean, it was an accounting program, basically. We keep track of your inventory and your receivables and payables and whatnot in this program.
Yeah.
And it allows you to share inventory with one another. What happened for me is it got me invited into the back office of all the major ticket brokers around the country. And I got to see the 101 different ways that they run their businesses. I mean, everybody had a different angle to the business, and I got a front row seat to all the different ways. And so the software company didn't make it. We got beat by another player in the space. But I had this lesson from being in all these ticket brokers' offices about all the different ways to run the business, and so I said, I think I'll give that a try. And that's in May of 2004, I started Red Carpet Tickets with that experience.
Okay. So how did you make that leap? You talk about like the sort of dynamics and even just the decision-making to jump off the cliff and, you know, build the wing, so to speak.
Well, I started with one customer, but it was a big one. I had, along the way with the software product, we had some VC backing. One of the members of the VC firm said, you know, what you really need to do is find somebody that can use this software product who's not a ticket broker. And I was like, well, it's ticket broker software. I don't get it. But he's like, no, prove that somebody besides a ticket broker could use this software to manage tickets. Well, about that time, I joined the Hills of Lakeway Golf Club. And my first newsletter that came from my club was an offer for Spurs tickets or tickets to Bass Concert Hall for theater or concerts at the Frank Irvin Center. I'm like, I wonder what this is about. So I went down and I met the woman that was the membership director for the Hills Club. And she had a desk drawer with tickets flowing out of it. And she was keeping track of tickets on a little Excel ledger. And I said, oh, I've got a solution for you. And so she was interested, but ultimately not the decision maker. So she introduced me to the president of Club Corp back in the Dallas office. So we had a meeting. Turned out we were born in the same hospital in South Texas. And we kind of hit it off. So he was interested in the software. He had a need for it. Didn't really have any budget for it. And somewhere along the way, he said, look, why don't you just come run this for us? Why don't you come manage tickets for Club Corp nationwide? Because we've got a need here. And that's where my relationship with Club Corp started. And so when the software company, when the writing was on the wall that we weren't going to win that space, I saw the opportunity to create a company around serving Club Corp.
All right. So I'm going to say luck, right? But it's a little bit of...
Well, you have to recognize luck when it's in front of you.
Yeah, it's aligned with what you're interested in. But there's some things that... I think the directionality is aligned with your passion, right?
Which right.
You were already golfing, right? You met Club Corp, right? So there's a lot of things that lined up.
Right, exactly.
No, that's really interesting. Do you miss... Or you get enough of the technical... You know, or do you have a desire, right? So you're an electrical engineer. You started in technology. Is what you're doing with HubSpot as an example, does that kind of really kind of light that part of, you know, I would say your interest level? And you don't miss like starting a software company.
No. In all honesty, I didn't love electrical engineering. I have found that my passion is in taking a company and growing revenue. Finding the levers to pull to grow revenue. That's what motivates me.
Okay. No, that's great. Any questions you want to ask me?
How are we as a client?
You know, that's a great question. So I shouldn't say this, but I will.
You're being recorded.
I know. I put them into buckets. You guys, I would say, quickly uptake new ideas faster than a lot. And I don't know if that's a startup, that's who you are, right? Because sometimes there's a lag, right? You introduce a new idea. Generally, the larger the organization, it takes longer. Generally, the smaller. But that's not always true.
Right.
Right? It's great. It's very collaborative, right? I think we introduce, and that's why I say, what is your framework for decision making? Because I think part of the reason you're seeing the success is also because you uptake some of the new concepts and ideas at a faster pace, right? And there's a good back and forth in collaboration, right? I would say, it's a long response, right? There's multiple. I think the fact that you're also like remote, it has forced you to build some different muscles.
Right.
That lends itself to a lot of the work that we do, right? And that's why I'm saying, like, by necessity, you have to, like, you kind of have to rely on the CRM system. Other clients, they know that they should, but they don't have to, right? There's some manual processes, there's ad hoc things that they can just kind of get by, right? And so for me, it's a joy, honestly, working with you guys, because what we're passionate about aligns with what you're passionate about.
Right.
And what you're doing in your business. So that was a long answer, but.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to maneuver in a fast motorboat than it is in a cargo ship.
It is. It is, although, again, I would say it's a general statement, but there's a lot of smaller companies that, you know, the things that we preach about being data-driven, there's certain, what I call, maturity level, or just the way they're set up, that just they're not set up to really uptake a lot of the new concepts and ideas. You know, and the same for big companies. There are some bigger companies that move faster because they're more aligned to a lot of things we do and vice versa.
So, well, thank you.
Thanks, Brian, for being our guinea pig.
My pleasure.